Well, good evening, everybody. Let me welcome you to the LSE Health and Social Care Annual Lecture. Delighted to see lots of familiar faces and some unfamiliar ones. Let me just, while we're just allowing some of the latecomers to get settled, let me just make one or two announcements about comfort and so on for the day. I've been told by six people so far to ask you to switch your mobile phones off. So, and normally my thought is, well, nobody ever rings me anyway, and then, of course, that's the time that they do. So if you could just check, that'd be great. Turn your phones off. Secondly, that obviously people do get a bit delayed coming in. There will be some people coming in late. If there is a seat, you could just move in and away from the gangway. That would be good, just to allow latecomers to come in. And if it's possible, unless you've got a desperate rush to get off, if you can hang on until we finish at 8 o'clock, that'll be really good, because it's a room where it's a bit disruptive when people leave early on. Even if they totally disagree with what Julian's saying, I think you should stay to the end. A couple of other things just quickly before we formally welcome Julian. There is a reception afterwards in the senior dining room in the main building, and there'll be people, I'll tell you again afterwards, there'll be people to shepherd you in that direction if you wish. If you leave here early, you don't get any wine. Okay, so please hang on until 8 o'clock. We've handed out, those of you that haven't had it already, some information about LSE Health and Social Care, and there are many people here, and if you would like to know more about the centre, we'd be very happy to tell you. But the main reason for being here is to listen to Julian, and I'm delighted to be able to welcome Julian as a colleague, even though he's currently on secondment, as many of you will know, to number 10. Julian has two positions, therefore. I mean, he's the Richard Titmuss Chair of Social Policy, Professor of Social Policy, here at the school. He's been here in that position since 93, but was here in a different department, a different incarnation earlier. He's had two other main institutions in his academic career, the University of Sussex and the University of Bristol, where he was at the School for Advanced Urban Studies and Professor of Public Policy. So I guess if your job titles include something in economics, public policy and social policy, it suggests a fairly wide spread of interests. And Julian's book last year, which I have to look at the papers, I always think of it as the Knights and Knaves book, but that's only the subtitle, The Motivation, Agency and Public Policy, was a very good example of the breadth of Julian's work, spanning quite a range of public policy areas. And I think he's going to draw on that today, and I think we'll have an opportunity to hear how his thinking in that area has developed further. Now I'm just going to pause to investigate what that sound is, if somebody knows what that strange squeaking sound. Okay, we'll... I think it's... Yes, okay. Well, it's being adjusted. It's being attended to. Thank you very much. Okay. That's fine. Okay. So, Julian, I'm delighted to be able to welcome you here. You are the colleague in the department. You're currently Senior Policy Advisor to the Prime Minister. And we very much look forward to your lecture on Choice, Voice and the Reform of Public Services. Julian Le Grand.
Thank you very much, Martin. First of all, can I test that this is all, people can hear me? All right, and let me also just test the IT. Right. I remember this time last year when we had a lecture by my predecessor, Simon Stevens, who is in the audience, actually, and we had great problems with the IT, and I remember he made some sort of crack about how many academics does it take to open a PowerPoint presentation. Since my lecture is rather similar to his, I think you could also ask the question, how many senior health policy advisors does it take to give a lecture? However, I'm going to take a slightly different tack from some things that he said, and as he also pointed out to me, only 1% of people can usually remember a lecture a year later, or can only remember 1% of the content. So hopefully it won't duplicate too much. I'm going to be talking mostly about choice, and I'm going to put the case for choice as best I can. I am going to say a little bit about voice, and I'm also going to talk about various other ways of trying to get a highly responsive, equitable, efficient public service, including some words about targets and performance management. But let me begin with choice for the moment. The aim, what we're trying to achieve, we're trying to get to lever up the quality of public services. And I shall concentrate mostly on healthcare and education, but it doesn't have to be only healthcare and education. Many of these arguments apply to social care, some apply to housing, apply to the wide range of services. And basically there are a set of different ways of doing this. And they include choice, and they include voice, they include centrally driven performance management and so on. Every system of public services has some sort of mixture of these involved. There's very few in any country in the world that relies exclusively upon one or the other. So usually what we're talking about is in some sense a shifting of the balance from one mechanism for levering up quality to the other. In this particular case, this government has, as indeed Simon showed last time, has used many of these instruments, and still is. But there is a bias towards the use of choice, an increasing use of choice, and that's what basically I want to give you the kind of case for that as we go through. So first of all, we have to say what we mean by choice, and this comes up time and time again, and of course there are a variety of different kinds of choice. The one I should be concentrating on is choice of provider, sort of whether we're talking about hospitals, GP surgeries, schools, the choice of school, choice of hospital, whatever. But of course that isn't the only form of choice. We can have choice of the service, what's provided, choice of treatment, choice of medical procedures, choice of curriculum in schools, choice of teaching method too, and so on. You can have the choice of time, when do you have the service, appointment time, opening hours, and so on. And the choice of access channel, how, sort of whether you face-to-face, on the web, telephone, or whatever. In fact, we tend to concentrate so far on choice of provider, partly because that is actually perceived often as a way of achieving some of these other ends, too, the way of getting diversity of service, is through having choice of provider, because different providers provide different services. The way of getting choice of time is to encourage people, different providers can offer different time slots and so on. So I think there's a legitimate case for focusing on choice of provider, and that's what I'll be doing. But some of the arguments are a bit different for some of these others, and perhaps during discussion time we can talk a bit about that. So what are the justifications for extending choice? Well, there are a number. The first, and I shall be sort of explaining these as we go through, the first is what people want. I'll come back to this in a moment. The desires of people, sort of intrinsic justification for choice is that people actually intrinsically value choice. A second is that it's an incentive mechanism. It's an incentive for driving up quality, for creating greater efficiency and more responsiveness in the system. Third is equity. It actually promotes equity. And I'm sure that already, some of you are already thinking, this sounds a bit perverse, because, of course, user choice, extending choice of services, can be criticised on precisely the same grounds. In other words, you can criticise it on the grounds of people don't want choice, they want a good local service. Anyone who's been in the choice game, you will hear this mantra time and time again, that people don't want choice, they want a good local service. So far from creating more efficient systems, though, it actually leads to inefficiency because you've got to have excess capacity, it fragments the service, and so on. It's inequitable. The poor are bad at making choices, or the poor are less successful at making choices than the middle class, and hence they will be disadvantaged. So by doing choice, you're promoting that. And then finally, there is one area of one problem with choice, which doesn't really have a counterpart on the justification side of things, which is the problem of cream skimming. That is to say, the problem that choice of user, the user choice, patient choice, pupil choice, parent choice, or whatever, that actually becomes not the choice of the parent, the pupil, or the patient, but the choice of the school or the hospital in situations of excess demand. So user choice becomes provider choice, and we get the problem of cream skimming. So let's just go through those arguments a bit. Now, firstly, what people want. Well, there's a plethora of evidence on this, much of which is contradictory, and it rather depends fairly crucially upon the way you ask the question and the way you frame the question. However, I would say that the bulk of the evidence tends to support the view that the people, yes, they do want choice. This is just one sample. It's from The Economist. They did a YouGov poll showing what people felt, how important it was to have more choice over which hospital treats you and your family and which state school children in your family attend. And getting on for 80% thought it was very important for schools, and getting on for 70% thought it was very or fairly important for hospitals. It's quite interesting that the next one on the other side is quite interesting too, with particular reference to the NHS, where a great emphasis that more people said the NHS needs to be reformed in order to give patients more control than people said the NHS needs more money, or there's nothing wrong with the NHS. So there seems to be a drive there for greater patient power, patient control. Of course, it's also worth pointing out that even if people don't want choice intrinsically, they don't have to have it. In a choice world, if they are given choice, they can choose to abrogate that choice. They can choose to place themselves. Many elderly people, and some of the contradictory evidence, do not necessarily want choice in the medical arena. They often say, "Oh well, doctor, you decide." But that is obviously perfectly acceptable. So the argument about choice does not mean that by giving people choice, you are in some sense disenfranchising those who don't want choice. If they don't want choice, they don't have to use it. But I think in many ways the real argument about choice is not actually an argument about its intrinsic value or its intrinsic merit or what really people want or whatever. The real argument about choice is the incentives that it gives. Now, it has to be certain kinds of choice, and we'll come to that. We'll come to some of the details in a minute. But in particular, but one condition does have to be fulfilled, which is that the choice has to be of the kind that consequences for the provider follow from being chosen or not being chosen. In other words, if you do choose a provider, that provider should benefit in some way. And if you don't, and if you take you decide not to go to a particular provider, that provider must lose. I mean, often this is done by the money following the choice, and that'll be the kind of system I'm talking about. But I think the easiest way to see the advantages of choice is to consider the alternatives. And then suppose we consider a system without choice, a monopolist system, a system that many people, in good faith, seriously advocate, where you have, say, fixed categories. It's usually in the context of schools, people talk about the need for schools, a fixed catchment area, but it happens with hospitals too. Now, suppose we had then, we had a system of completely fixed catchment areas that where you went to school was determined by your place of residence, basically. You did not have a choice. You had to send your children to the local school. You had to go to the local hospital. Well, in that case, the success of your system, the success would depend, if it was going to work at all, if it was going to lever up quality, you're going to be reliant upon a number of mechanisms. You aren't obviously reliant on choice. There are a variety of, except in a limited sense, we'll come to in a moment. The first thing, you rely on trust. You basically trust the professionalism of the hospital staff, and the school staff should be up there as well. Somebody did once challenge me recently that whether I could ever get through a lecture without mentioning knights and knaves. Well, I can't. Has to be a bit. For those of you, I hope very few haven't come across the knights and knaves. So what I'm referring to there is the quote by David Hume in the 18th century, where he said when you're organising government, whether it's a health service or an education system, a public system, you should do so on the assumption that everybody who works within it is a knave. Well, actually, i.e. self-interested, an egoistic, self-interested individual. Actually, of course, as those of you who have read the book will know, if you look at the organisation of the British welfare state, in its early years, at any rate, it was constructed on precisely the opposite assumption. Constructed on the assumption that people were not knaves, but rather they were public-spirited altruists, that their principal concern was with the people they were dealing with. So doctors' only concern was with their patients, teachers with their pupils, and so on. And if you essentially go down the fixed catchment area route, you would have to rely upon one of these mechanisms. This would, in some sense, have to be true for your system to work. And there are people who argue this. David Markwand, in a book some of you may have come across about the public realm, he wants to go back to a period when we trusted the professionals. And it's Colin Crouch in a pamphlet on the Fabian Society has also argued rather similarly. But that's one mechanism. A second mechanism, and here comes voice, is you rely upon voice. So if you're kind of an unsatisfactory service, since you cannot leave the school or you cannot go to the hospital, you cannot go to another hospital, you have to express your voice in some way, your dissatisfaction in some way. And that might be verbally, I mean just going and trying to persuade the teacher to give more attention to your child or persuade the hospital you need certain treatment or whatever. If that doesn't work, you might have to reform to more formal forms of voice, like appeals procedures. Of course, too, I mean, you might, in the end, be so dissatisfied with the school or hospital that you actually resort to another form of voice, which is elections. You actually vote. You vote out the local government or the central government, indeed, that was responsible for giving you this particular bad service. So you can voice. It would be another mechanism by which you try and lever up quality. And then finally, a third is centrally driven performance management, by which basically the centre, the government, in some form or another, tries to lever up quality, tries to get a high-quality service through the use of targets and penalties for failing to meet the target and rewards for achieving them. And clearly, this government has used quite extensively the centrally driven performance management agenda. It's relied on voice to some extent. Probably not relied a great deal upon the trust mechanism. But is now, as I say, moving towards choice. And finally, of course, there is an element of choice in this system. There is some choice in operation, but it's choice of residence. So you can choose if one school is rather good in a particular catchment area, the only way you can get into it is by moving your residence into it as best you can. So there is an element of choice, but it's rather restricted kind. Now, all of these mechanisms seem to me to have problems with them as a mechanism for trying to lever up quality. Not to imply that choice does not, but all of these three do. If you take trust, the first is that actually, as indeed we know from quite a lot of research evidence and the way, both from laboratory experiments and experiments looking at motivation and from studies of the way people actually behave, actually they are not knights. Even doctors, even teachers, even university professors, difficult though this is to believe, are not completely knights. They're not completely knaves either, at least most of them are not completely knaves either. But it is a highly complex series of motivations, a mixture of the knight and knave. If you rely upon the trust mechanism, you are relying in some sense upon exclusivity of knightly motivations. And if knavish motivations are in there, you have a real problem, because those knavish motivations, they're untrammeled by anything. There's no... they're only trammelled, in a sense, by the individual's own knightly side. So you've got a problem if you're relying entirely on knightliness, and knightliness isn't much there. It's also true that even if you do have a perfect knight, they may well have their own agendas. It is one of the problems a bit that it's an interesting part of the debate has often been about the use of voluntary organisations or non-profit organisations to provide services, partly to overcome this problem of the knightly and knavish motivation. The assumption is that a non-profit organisations will actually not exploit their monopoly situation in this situation, but will behave in a relatively knightly fashion. But of course, many non-profits have their own agendas. If it's a church, for instance, it has its agenda, which may not be the same as the government's agenda, and may not be the same as the user's agenda. So you have to be a little careful about that. And also, knights tend to be a bit uncomfortable with consumers. If you're a user and you're a pushy user and you're a demanding user, then the knights, whether they're a doctor, lecturer, or indeed a university professor, often tend to get a bit uncomfortable with this. They tend to prefer, if you're going to be altruistic to somebody, you tend to prefer a certain passivity on behalf of the recipient. You don't really want them standing up and demanding their rights. It doesn't seem quite appropriate. In fact, there's an interesting study by a colleague of mine in the department here, Hartley Dean, who looked at social workers and their clients. He found the social workers brimming over with knightliness. I mean, they were really dedicated to their job. But they did not like pushy clients. They really wanted their client. Their clients had to be compliant and good. And they used phrases of that kind. So that if you're in a world where you actually want your users of services to be empowered in some sense, to have some control and so on, then maybe relying on knights is not wholly a good idea. Voice, well, I will be the first to admit, I think one needs to do more work on voice. We haven't really seen a proper sort of theoretical discussion, it seems to me, of the advantages and disadvantages of voice and the way it might work, partly because there are so many different kinds of voice. I mean, I tend to think these mechanisms are clunky. I mean, appeals procedure, verbal persuasion is less clunky, but appeals procedures and ultimately going up to elections, these are not exactly refined tools for trying to improve quality on a day-by-day basis. And I also think that they tend to favour the better off. It's the argument often levelled against choice, is that it favours the middle classes. But I think the same case could be made, perhaps even more so, against most voice mechanisms, possible exception of voting, but things like appeals procedures and so on require an articulacy, require a confidence, require an ability to manipulate the system, which often the poor do not have. And I mean, you can see we did with some colleagues, I see one of the colleagues is in the audience here, did some work looking at the National Health Service and the extent which is during the period we were looking at is basically relying upon voice mechanisms to see what equity concerns we had, and there were just a number of factors, all of which are listed here, which actually showed how the poor in a system that was ostensibly designed to be equitable and fair actually was ending up favouring the better off through the variety of mechanisms. And similarly with education, which until 1988 at any rate was largely allocated on the base of catchment areas, has to be said it still very, in many ways largely is, although there is an element, there is more choice. But actually the segregation was worse in 1988 than it is now. That's segregation as measured by the proportion of children who take free school meals in a school. If we had no segregation, you'd expect that proportion to be the same in every school. So there are various measures of segregation looking at inequality differences in that. Decline in segregation, 1985. Segregation, the evidence suggests that segregation is higher in areas that use catchment areas. One interesting fact, this is I should come back to this, I'll just plop it in here for the moment, there is a belief that with catchment areas you end up with local school people going to their local school and their local community. Well, we don't really see that, and that's largely because the catchment areas often actually contain several might contain several schools, but this is a point I wish I returned to. And of course, the point about choice of residence, there's interesting work by Steve Machin and others that shows just how sensitive house prices are to particularly primary school performance, the performance of primary schools, suggesting that the mechanism sorting out where people live, where people go to school, is via where they live. So, performance management. Well, I am trained as an economist and always been deeply sceptical of what we call performance management, or indeed we used to call command and control. Now that I'm working in government, I can suddenly see something. It's funny that. I certainly have been, and I shall excuse me, I've certainly been more impressed than I have been historically at the way performance management works. And I think, again, I think this is ripe for any budding PhDs in the audience or people doing research. I think, again, we need probably, just as we do with voice, we need somebody really to go into this theoretically and have a look at the reasons why performance management works and doesn't. I think it tends to work in the short term with simple objectives. If you've got a simple objective, a simple target, you want to raise the literacy rate. Say Cuba, for instance, would be very successful in sort of basically performance management. They wanted to raise the literacy rate, they wanted to lower the infant mortality rate. You throw resources at this problem and you can do it. I also think it has one of... This is an illustration of how it works with my colleague, Gwyn Bevan, who has kindly allowed me to use these. This is an illustration of this is the percentage of patients waiting for hospital admission in England, waiting more than 12 months in England. This is a National Health Service that has deliberately adopted the strategy of targets. There are also other things going on here, and I don't necessarily attribute this entirely to targets. It's, of course, the wisdom of my predecessors at my job. No doubt have been crucial in the fact of the politicians concerned. But targets played a key element in it. And it's very interesting when you look at some of the other societies that some of the other members of the United Kingdom that have not been so enthusiastic about targets. In fact, often have explicitly rejected targets. Indeed, actually, in the Welsh case, somewhat embarrassingly, quoting me in doing so. And this is Wales. What's happening in the Welsh situation? I mean, Scotland's very interesting because it started well below, as you can see, in 2000 with the numbers of people waiting, but has steadily moved up. Northern Ireland is way above the lot. If you take another target, the accident and emergency target, the percentage of people seen within 4 hours, that is seen and discharged or admitted into hospital, so the full gamut. It's a target that's on its way to being achieved, but we want to get 98% of people achieved it. It's well on its way to being achieved and probably will be achieved. And interestingly enough, this has internationally been rather admired. We've had visitors from Australia and America coming and saying it's actually unprecedented. I did not realise until this that actually in most other countries, long waits and accidents and emergencies, I thought they were a British problem, but they turn out most other countries have them in one form or another. Something has worked in England over the past few years to do this, I believe that actually when you look at the balance, it is to some extent centrally-driven performance management with targets. This is at the same time as there's been a 20% increase in numbers in accidents and emergency. And thank you, Gwyn, for pointing, allowing me to use these as evidence. It seems to me to work in the short term with simple objectives. It may work better than the alternatives, trust or voice alternatives. It's certainly true that when we were trusting the doctors to get access to emergency doctors or the hospital administrators, the nurses to get waiting lists down and so on, we didn't have anything like that kind of response. In fact, everything went wrong. And indeed, of course, in many cases, the other countries of the United Kingdom are relying on trust. External targets are useful for internal management purposes. We had the Prime Minister occasionally has breakfasts where various people are invited in. In this case, it was frontline accident and emergency staff. Not so much frontline as the managers of accident and emergency departments to sort of tell him a bit about what was going on in the context of removing the target. And we discussed the question about whether we should lift the target. And they said, for God's sake, don't. Don't lift the target. It's the only way that we can actually get our internal people to actually undertake the relevant protocols to operate in the way that we want them to. So clearly being able to blame the government is a useful mechanism for getting it going internally. But I must say, I still don't think in the long run is the way to go. In the long run, it seems to me that a heavy use of targets, a heavy use of penalties and rewards does lead to an ultimate demoralisation of the workforce, and it stifles innovation. I should have said, of course, in fact, I thought I had said, but clearly not. It distorts, as we all know, the whole distortionary aspect of targets that it tends to distort towards particular areas. But I think I needed to offer a slight recantation of some of my previous views on the role of targets and centralisation. So, back to choice. So, in theory, you could extend patient or pupil choice with money following the choice. And the possible result could be, ideally, it would incentivise staff. Providers who were losing custom would be incentivized to improve their standards, lead to greater productivity and greater responsiveness. The fairly standard arguments in favor of a choice or a contestable market would be familiar to many people here. You can have more equity through reducing the role of voice mechanisms. You're less reliant upon inequitable voice. And you can extend choice to those who can't move to good areas in the way that with a catchment area system you're reliant upon that. But there is the problem of cream skimming, and let me come back to that in a moment. What about choice in practice? Well, we've got a bit of experience now in the UK, and we've had some choice pilots. Where we experimented with in various specialties, cardiac particularly, but also cataract operations and so on. And when we offered people a choice in London, 67% took it up, 75% in Manchester, and 50% across the country in the cardiac scheme. Slightly, not misleading exactly, but you do have to remember that in these cases, in these choice pilots, they were all cases where people had been waiting for 6 months already. So many of them were quite keen to get their service, but they were prepared to move. And they were often prepared to move quite long distances. I went out, actually, with a patient care advisor who was advising people on making choices, and some of her patients had actually gone from Birmingham to Brussels. Had a very good time, actually. I spoke to many of them. But people were prepared to travel, and they're prepared to travel long distances. In England, excluding London, 6 months ending March 2003, there was a fall in ophthalmology referrals, but a decline in the mean waiting time. But in London, where we had a choice project operate, there was actually an increase in referrals, but nonetheless, there was a decline in waiting time, and the decline in waiting time was greater, significantly greater, than the decline in England as a whole. There's quite a lot of international evidence now upon choice, mostly in education. And there's a kind of pattern that emerges in it. I'm not going to go through it in detail here, but there usually are positive effects on quality, productivity, and responsiveness. Usually it leads to improvement in quality with some responsiveness and a more efficient system. It's not always quite as big as those of us who advocate choice would like. Some of the effects are not quite as dramatic as one would like, but they usually are positive. There often is an impact on equity, and it really comes about the cream skimming problem, the problem that in some cases the providers actually choose, although perhaps it does better than the alternatives. And there is a problem, but there is, I mean, I indicated that I think that the choice does better for the poor than voice does, but that doesn't mean to say there isn't still a problem for choice for the poor. One of the things that also comes out is that choice works badly if the systems are poorly designed. Particularly internal structures, one of the interesting studies in Milwaukee, looking at voucher schemes in Milwaukee in education, was that the teachers in the schools that were losing pupils did not know that the school was losing money through losing pupils. So actually, the teachers were rather delighted to lose pupils because they could get rid of all the difficult ones. So they actually encouraged the lot of them without being aware that no one had actually informed them that actually the system was working against their long-term interests. And of course, that blunts or destroys the incentive system. choice, so far from being an alternative to having a good local service, choice may be the way that you get a good local service. But of course, there are conditions under which this would operate. You cannot automatically assume that with choice you will get this. There are certain conditions that have to be fulfilled. And the first is, of course, there have got to be alternatives. You've got to have a choice. You've got to be able to go somewhere else. We'll come back to that in a moment. You need good information, of course. You do need information about the choices being offered, including, especially for the disadvantaged. And maybe you do need to offer assistance where necessary to help people make the choices. You want the transactions cost, the whole business, to be low. That's the business. I mean, if you've got money following the choice, you've got have billing systems, accounting systems. These can be expensive in terms of transactions cost. You want those to be low. You do want the motivation issue. It doesn't really matter if they're a knight or a knave, your head teacher or your person running the hospital, but you do want them to be sensitive to finance. You do want them to, so because particularly if the money is following the choice, if they don't care whether their hospital goes bankrupt or their school goes under financially, then this particular version of choice will not work. And there is a problem, I think, particularly in the health service, and I don't think we've necessarily cracked it, which is that in many cases, the key decision makers in hospitals are not managers or not people concerned with budgets, they are consultants. And the study that I did with a PhD student here, Tessa Crilly, did suggest that consultants' objectives often dominated the hospital trust objective of breaking even or whatever. Consultants were more concerned about quality of service provided. So you do have a problem there to make sure that your choice system works. And you've really got to do something about the opportunities and incentives for cream skimming. Again, I'll return to it. Availability of alternatives. There's a lot of nonsense talked about this. The rural school and the rural hospital rear their head when we talk about choice. This is a massive problem. Reminds me of it's the Inland Revenue objection. The Inland Revenue was always when it didn't like a particular tax proposal. It would go to ministers and say, ministers have got a real problem here. It's people who live in caravans. And it became known as the caravan objection. And the rural school has elements, and the rural has elements of that. In fact, some work by Carol Proper at Bristol demonstrated that 92% of the population had looking at travel time, had two or more acute NHS trusts within 60 minutes. 98% had up to 100 available and unoccupied NHS beds. And 76% had up to 500 available and unoccupied beds, which is an interesting fact. I mean, just it's interesting about the way we're using our capacity at the moment if we have all this available and unoccupied beds without choice. If you look at education, you get rather similar again. This is again, some of this is work that's going on at Bristol with Simon Burgess and others. But 32% of maintained secondary schools have two or more schools within 1 mile of them, 80% within 3 miles of them. And the average length of journey to school is 11 to 16 year olds in England is 3 miles. So 4/5 of English schools have at least two other potential choices, attendance of which would entail little, if extra, travelling. And barely 1 in 10 schools, in fact, have no potential alternative within 3 miles. So the rural school or the rural hospital is not quite the caravan level. Obviously, there's still 10% of schools that don't. Clearly, we've got to think about those that don't have adequate alternatives within 3 miles. But nonetheless, it's not so massive a problem as to seriously derail the policy. Finally, let me say a word or two, and then coming to the end, Martin, let me just say a word or two about cream skimming, since I've referred to it several times, because I do think this is the problem. I do think this is the problem of choice, particularly so far as schools are concerned. Not so much a problem in hospitals. Let me just explain again a little bit what it is, cream skimming. It's the notion that everybody wants to go to the good local school, everybody wants to go to the good local hospital. Queues build up, waiting lists build up for the hospital, waiting lists build up for the school. So the school, being driven partly by financial considerations under a choice mechanism, thinks about, well, who are going to be the cheapest people to teach? Who are going to be the easiest people to teach? There may be other considerations like wanting to raise their status in the league tables and so on, professional considerations. So they choose the easiest people to teach, the cheapest people to teach, the most effective people to teach. You often, not necessarily, but often the better off. And so basically they disadvantage the poor or they disadvantage the less able and choose the more able. Hospitals, the argument would be they'll tend to choose the patient that is the easiest to treat, the patient who, with the money they're getting for that patient, they can actually make some sort of profit on. I think in the case of hospitals, I'm not sure the cream skimming is actually all that much of a problem. It isn't actually all that easy to predict a priori which patients are going to be more expensive to treat. You can't just look at a waiting list and necessarily and say this patient is going to be more expensive to treat than another. And also we can refine, we are trying to refine our system. We have a new system going in called payment by results, which is a tariff system by which we pay a fixed tariff for a particular diagnosis. We're trying to refine that to discourage cream skimming. It's also an area, I may say, where maybe the fact that consultants actually make the relevant decisions actually works to our advantage, because consultants are often interested in patients. They aren't necessarily concerned, in this case, about the financial consequences and therefore possibly not cream skimming. Schools, on the other hand, I think is another matter, and there is a lot of evidence, actually, that cream skimming is just taking place in systems that involve choices, particularly in New Zealand. Well, there are a number of things you can do about it, though. You don't just have to lie down. And in a way, this illustrates the most fundamental point, that choice systems will work if they are properly designed. But they do have to be properly designed. And you could have stop-loss insurance. That is basically where you say you have some kind of insurance pool. So if a hospital or a school takes on somebody who is difficult or expensive in some way, there is an insurance mechanism that they can get recoup for that. You can have no provider discretion over admission. You can charter schools in the United States tend to operate on a lottery system. If you've got a long waiting list, people are allocated by lottery to the places. In fact, interestingly enough, it's apparently very widely accepted. I mean, you'd think that many people would just say lotteries are so unfair or whatever, but actually, apparently, it works quite well. It is quite widely accepted. In some ways, I think that's probably the mechanism I prefer. You can risk adjust the tariff. That is to say, if you've got more expensive patients, more expensive pupils, you can actually pay more with them. And the one that I particularly like is you actually adjust it by socioeconomic group. That is to say, the poorer, so for instance, children from poorer schools would have a tariff that was larger than, sorry, children from poorer backgrounds would have a larger tariff than those from cheaper backgrounds. Quite an interesting idea, actually, that has also been put forward in the States, where it depends, the size of the amount of money you get per child depends not only upon the background of the child, but also upon the background of the majority of pupils at the school. So a middle-class school that took on working-class children would get a lot more money per child in consequence. But a working-class child that took on middle-class children, a working-class school that took on middle-class children, would also get more money per child, so as to encourage the... So you can use the system to achieve its aims. So... at that point, I'm going to stop. There is actually one other slide, but I'll skip that for the moment. Leaving you with just the general point that, of course, choice is not the answer to all problems. Of course, we will still need to rely on voice. Of course, we will still need to rely upon centrally driven performance management and targets and so on, I suspect, to some extent. And, of course, too, choice will only work in certain areas, in certain conditions. Those doesn't have to be right. But I am basically going to leave you with the proposition that I think, on the whole, a well-designed choice system is more likely to achieve an efficient and equitable and responsive public service than the alternatives. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Julian. I can't imagine anybody's got any questions, but we'll just allow a bit of time. Now, there are a couple of microphones, so if you can just wait till the microphone reaches you. So we've got one there. If you want to, okay, so we'll have one and two. So, and could you just say, there's one up there. Keep your hand up. So if you can just say who you are and, if it's appropriate, your affiliation, that would be helpful.
I don't think it is, no, but speak loudly.
I'll speak loudly.
Actually, we'll try the microphone.
I'll try
again.
Is it switched off? Can you just...
Okay, that sounds much better. I'm a general practitioner in Hammersmith and member of the Professional Executive Committee in the Borough of Hammersmith and Fulham. Very interested in the levers and methods that the system might be changed through choice and the way you've portrayed it. But what I'm very interested in hearing your views on is how the catchphrase, which is very prominent in my area, demand management, fits into this. Because what we've got is a background of demand which is outstripping supply, and you mentioned 20% increase in A&E attendances. I think a focus in my particular area is a centralised one that I want to draw attention to about how to provide better for the needs that are coming forward, and that isn't necessarily well focused from the patient.
Shall I ask? All right. Yes, well, this really refers to choice of treatment rather than choice of provider. And there clearly is an issue. Because when we're talking about choice of provider, at least in the healthcare case, basically we're saying to the GP will make the diagnosis. There will be an amount of money associated with that diagnosis, and the GP, in conjunction with the patient, will then the GP will advise the patient, and the patient will choose alternative providers who'll take the same money. So there's no, and the same this will provide the similar service or whatever. So there's no sort of cost inflation or problem about demand management in that sense. What there is a problem about is as you say, well, one aspect, of course, if we start lowering waiting times, like for A&E, then, of course, because it, in some sense, is a price, if you lower the price of going to accident and emergency departments, you're going to get more people going. And that's one of the prices of success. But there is a more general issue about, ought we not to be giving patients more control over or more choices over the treatments that they get? Now, then you do hit a problem because of the money issue. Suppose patients always choose the most expensive option. Can we allow them, in some sense, to do that in a tax-constrained system? In fact, of course, the interesting thing is that actually when patients are offered choices, they often do not choose the most expensive option. They often go for certainly less invasive surgery they prefer. So it may be this is a problem we shouldn't worry too much about. But I am, I must say, worried about the National Health Service in general, is that we are putting in place a system of dangers of massive cost inflation, with powerful hospitals being paid for by the amount of operations they do, a great incentive in order to maintain financial balance to try and hoover in as much work as possible, influencing the GPs, influencing the patients, and so on. That is a problem, and I think demand management, getting that under control, is very important. We do have ideas about that, practice-based commissioning, indeed, but we can talk about that.
Okay, I've got a number of people with their hands up. Is there anybody that I've already identified want to follow on that point? Because if not,
Hello, Sarah Fogarty. I'm a lecturer at Suffolk College in the Faculty of Health. I'm just making some general comments on what you've just spoken regarding choice, just a few things that you might pass comment on. And just to pick up on the point regarding Cuba, I was at the Peter Bourne lecture and did hear some of that, and some of the incentives for Cuba were actually politically driven from other forces worldwide. There was lots of other things impacting on that, though I do recognise some of the value that came from that. Regarding what you're saying about choice, and I do recognise how that links into finance and cost savings, but in terms of how you're talking about cross-cutting issues about prevention and public health, given your examples of choice pilots, for example, in some areas cardiac targets were actually met, and you're actually looking at more upstream, or have I got the right way around, upstream initiatives that prevent people actually getting to cardiac situations anyway. And then if you link in that to schools, and you were saying about choice about parents within 3-mile radius having choice to get children to schools, one of the issues linking that into cross-cutting around transportation and getting people off the roads and walking to schools, this is a big area not only for urban issues but for rural areas where there are issues of safety, practicalities on the road with road safety and stuff like that. So whilst I recognise you were giving general overview, there are lots of specifics that drill down to the localities. And also in terms of the hospital use around the country, some hospitals are actually working to full capacity, so I would actually take issue with some of the comment you make, although I do recognise you're talking generally. And if you're actually talking about a health needs assessment locally for the population to engage them and what they need, then that cannot be centrally driven. That has to be locally managed with support from policy that is actually enabling that to happen. So that's some of my comments. There's a lot more I could say, actually.
Well, let me just reply to some of the points. Transport, yes, it is an issue. Although, as I indicated, at least for schools, there's a lot of transport going on already. It's not as if we sort of work in a situation where everyone's going to the local school. I mean, the work that's been done by Simon Murgis and others at Bristol shows that 55% of people are not going to their local school. So there's a lot of transportation going around already. But yes, it may well be it is a cost that we have to incur. And I agree that does work against some of our other policies, like encouraging children to walk to school and so on. But maybe we can't have everything. I also accept the point that, I mean, public health concerns, for instance. Choice is not designed to solve every problem with public services or indeed with health or healthcare. And public health requires a range of other measures. I must say, it is interesting psychologically how when I come to public, I'm deeply in favour of choice, as you see, in public services. I'm carrying a bit of a reputation in government at the moment for being a banner as far as public health is concerned. Banning smoking in public places, restricting TV advertising of junk foods and so on. The trouble is, in public health areas, I must say, the measures that seem to work most effectively have been measures that actually restrict people's choices rather than the measures that actually encourage people's choices. So that's a philosophical problem for me, although probably not for you.
I've got Nick
Nick Bosengedder, Professor of Health Policy at Imperial College. I'm surprised, perhaps you thought it was so obvious it didn't need mentioning, Julian, that you didn't put differences in aptitudes, interests and perspectives of the customers as perhaps the most important single reason for trying to get more choice. And if everybody was the same, then one single collectivized monistic a monolithic service would be the ideal way of doing things. But as in education, clearly there are so many differences in aptitudes and interests, then choice leading to a more varied supply side with different kinds of city academies and so on, which seems to be a very good way ahead, is surely absolutely crucial. Now the question is, do the same arguments apply in the health service or in health services? And there's already clear evidence, for example, in the treatment of prostate cancer, that where you bring in patient preferences, you start to get quite a lot of changes. But since people became more aware of the side effects of the TURPS operation, the number of operations has gone down by half. And people are seeking other treatment routes. Now, there are a lot of other areas where it's going to be a very painful cultural change by the health service to start offering, as it were, different packages to meet different interests and different desires to get something out of healthcare. But don't give up on health. We need a more varied response because of the differences in aptitude and interest, and we need a much more varied supply side.
Yes, I do indeed agree. I did actually mention right at the beginning that that I did think one of the advantages of choice of provider was it did give you choice. It not only gave you choice of provider, but it also gave you choice of service as well. But I agree. I do think that is one of the ability of a choice-driven system to generate diversity of supply is one of its biggest assets.
Okay, question over here.
Simon Burgess, Centre for Market and Public Organisation in Bristol. Two comments. One is that when you were discussing the alternatives to choice and you were talking about local monopolies or what you might think of as neighbourhood schooling, I think the people that are against choice and are in favour of that sort of thing have to recognise that it produces an alternative way of choosing that you discussed at the very end, which is choice of residence. And in fact, there's a lot of work that shows the closer you tie attendance to a particular school to where you live, the more segregated communities you achieve in terms of residence. So you get much richer communities focused around particular schools. So choice of schooling has implications for residential segregation, which are also very important. On the other hand, something else you said was that in a world of choice, people are free not to choose and everything's lovely and everyone's happy. But of course, the way the system's set up at the moment, that's not true, because one person's choice to go to a particular school has implications for the chances of others to go to that school. And so when we're thinking about those half of kids who don't go to their neighbourhood school, the picture not to have in your mind is all these focused choosing people, choosing proactively to go somewhere else. But some of these kids will be kids who can't go to their local school because others have chosen to come there. So that there is, in the system as you described, where we have choice by parents but also by the providers, you have to interpret the people going elsewhere, not necessarily as being voluntary.
Yes, I agree with that last point. And I was really using the fact that people didn't go to their local school more as part of the argument to rebut the argument that we presently have a system of local schools and you're proposing to destroy it. Which we clearly do not. But yes, and it relates, I think, to some of the points that somebody else is making, that there's no doubt that to have that if we're to overcome some of the dangers of choice, and particularly the cream-skimming problem and so on, another route has to be, in some sense, increasing supply. We have to have mechanisms for... Well, again, it's quite interesting... I would have thought a priori that it would be much more difficult to increase supply in healthcare than it would be in education. that actually would be much more difficult to increase, to get new treatment centres, new hospitals or whatever, than it would be to start schools. I mean, just purely on things like the capital equipment required, for instance, there seems to be far less for schools. And there's lots of evidence that actually small schools can be started quite quickly internationally and do quite well. In practice in England, it's turned out to be enormous. We've done quite well. I mean, an enormous amount of effort, as Simon will confirm, to actually increase capacity in hospitals. But we are introducing new treatment centres, and there are areas of the country where soon we may well have an excess of capacity, which relates back to your point earlier. But schools have turned out to be enormously difficult. I mean, schools, to start a new school, there are things called school organising committees. I don't know whether anyone here is from that area, but they operate basically as cartels. And make it extraordinarily difficult to start new schools. And it turns out, compared with, say, Holland, where if 300 parents can get together, they can demand money from the state to start a new school. So I think the key has to be increasing the supply.
There's a very enthusiastic... If you want to follow up on this point, okay, that's fine. I've got plenty of others, and then so don't put any more hands up for the moment. Thank you.
Helen Shirley Quirk, formerly of the Department of Health, but now the British Red Cross. Following on that point about increased supply, I'm interested that you haven't mentioned much about the issues around efficiency or otherwise. We've talked about Professor Bosanquet talked about informed choice, about patients choosing alternative prostate cancer treatments. That is dependent on having very good information about the relative merits, which actually in one of the studies I've seen needs to be provided by a nurse, i.e. not a radiologist or a surgeon with their own preferred options. Informed choice immediately increases the transaction costs of running the system, coupled with the need for increased capacity, especially if we're going to combine it with continuing waiting times targets. You've talked a lot about the quality benefits. Do you what's your view on the efficiency side of it?
Well, you're right. There are resource implications about a good choice system, including capacity, including the need for good information systems. Although I would argue that many of those are probably a good aspect of other kinds of system too. For instance, I mean, voice is not going to work effectively as a means of levering up quality if the people exercising the voice are not properly informed. To make a voice system work effectively, you need very good information. One of them, just as you do for a choice system. So I wouldn't really accept that choice is necessarily more expensive in that role. On the capacity issue, it is interesting. There are experiments now with choice-based lettings in council housing, which is an area where we don't have excess capacity. And yet it's quite successful. I mean, it means, and of course in some degree, I mean, the choice pilots I talked about, these weren't really situations of excess capacity. They were long waiting lists, and basically what people were choosing was to go on a shorter waiting list. But there's no doubt, and it relates to the earlier point, that a choice system works best if there is a certain margin of excess capacity. And yes, that will be expensive, and maybe that's a price we have to pay.
Okay.
My name is Michael Williams from Birkbeck College. I've read your book and I listened to your lecture, and one topic that you haven't raised is the implications of relying on choice for the internal governance of institutions. It seems to me that if you are relying on centrally set targets for achieving certain goals, then you need one kind of institutional structure. Basically, you need powerful managers who are able to incentivize and direct their staff. Whereas if you need institutions that are designed to be responsive and attract customers, etc., you need a different kind of governance. And in particular, you need an institution where there is not where the signals to managers are the same as the signals to the professionals who are actually delivering the services. And it seems to me the real problem with the way the public sector is organized is the system of general management. Because if you think about the way professional services in the private sector are organized, they're not run by general managers. The management task is fulfilled by the professionals operating, if you like, with a different hat on, or with managers who are in fact subordinate to the professionals. So perhaps the organisational model needs to be different. It needs to be modelled perhaps on barristers' chambers or architects' practices or management consultancies. Or firms of accountants, or perhaps the way private schools are run. I do think the focus on choice requires a rethink of internal governance of institutions.
Yes, I mean, I agree, and I did actually make the point that I thought that internal structures are important to get that right. And I did mention the problem that we do have in healthcare, which is that consultants often make the relevant resource allocation decisions, and yet they do not necessarily give the priority towards maintaining financial balance that the managers would. I think I rather agree that in the long run, I mean, I tend to prefer medical managers. When I think about the way running hospitals, the idea that they're actually run by doctors or doctors who've shifted into a management hat. Rather similar, of course, to universities. I mean, universities often tend to run by using academics as in the management structure. And in fact, there was some interesting research that actually looked at the success of universities as measured by a variety of indicators, but including financial management. And on the whole, it was the ones that had a greater involvement of academics in the management structures that did better than the others, when you controlled for everything. Which I'm sure will please a number of people in this audience. And indeed, I mean, it's quite interesting. I mean, Cambridge is probably the worst managed, at least from a conventional point of view, university in the United Kingdom. And yet, for many people, would argue it's the best.
Okay. This gentleman in the front. We've had right and left. We'll have centre now.
Dirk Müller, London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. I've got a question to you in terms of the implications on equity. And that is that I see huge problems there when you look at the costs of an informed choice, especially for the poorer or deprived parts of the population. If we look at the amounts of principal-agent relationships, particularly in the healthcare sector, I wonder how it will be possible to mitigate the inequalities that might resolve from that, and especially when you mentioned in the beginning the elderly people who sometimes don't actually want the choice. I wonder, is that not rather a result of them not making an informed choice and their high costs for getting this information?
Yes, I do think that there are costs. It relates to your information point. Particularly for poor groups. The choice pilot schemes had what they called patient care advisors. I mentioned them briefly. And in the cardiac scheme, they were trained nurses, which had a resource implication. It meant those trained nurses were not on the wards. But they were advising patients. They were very successful. I mean, they were very deeply popular with patients. And a story some of you have heard that I was out with one of them, she was providing all sorts of information, but not very much to do with choice. For instance, her mobile phone rang, and it was an elderly patient who was about to go into surgery for a heart operation and had been told to lay off aspirin. And now she'd been using aspirin for much of her recent life, and she was puzzled. She said, "Why do I have to lay off aspirin?" The answer is because actually aspirin thins the blood and makes it more difficult to coagulate after the operation. But the nurse explained this to her, and she was went away perfectly happy. And it was quite an interesting example of how we could use this patient care advisor to provide not only a range of services around choice, but also a sort of rather better sort of service across. Of course, somebody did say to me, "Well, why didn't the consultant tell her that?" And somebody else said to me, "Well, we've got a system of patient care advisors. They're called doctors." So there is an issue there, and there is a resource intensity that might well, if we are going down this kind of care advisor route, then there is a problem.
Okay, there's one. You've been waiting patiently. Yes, that's fine.
Right, thanks. David Evans from UWE Bristol. Thanks very much for that, Julian. I found that very stimulating. Just an observation and a question. I mean, I think that during your talk, you did talk a lot more about choice than voice, and you did, I mean, you said at the very beginning that obviously there are a range of mechanisms and it's about shifting the balance, and you also said that you thought more work needed to be done on voice and that it was potentially under-theorized now. And I mean, I was just observing that during this conversation, we've been talking a lot more about choice again than about voice. And I just wonder, my question really is, are we not potentially setting up something of a false dichotomy? Because as one of those parents who's living in an area with poor secondary schools, with a child in year five, I've been observing my own behavior, my family's behavior, and the behavior of a lot of families around us. And it seems to me that people have got multiple strategies. So A, people look at private schools. B, they think about moving house, buying property. But C, they get involved in governing bodies. They set up campaign groups. They lobby MPs and local authority members. So it seems to me that people have got a range of strategies around their personal family objectives. And some of those we categorize as choice and some as voice. But actually, I think that there are complex interactions between the two. And maybe we need to take a step back and actually start from the real world of how people operate rather than apply somewhat theoretical concepts of choice and voice. Thanks.
Yes, I'm not sure I'd agree with that last part. It does seem to me that theory is very useful. And you do need, if you're going to analytically separate out, and we, I mean, economists have developed a fairly elaborate theories about choice and the conditions under which choice and competition and markets will work. And on the whole, we don't have a very good set of theories, I think, about non-choice systems and how they work. And I think we'd have a much better understanding if we did. But on your sort of your more general point about the extent to which choice and voice are alternatives, or maybe part of similar strategies that, or a set of strategies that people are up, I rather agree with that. I mean, it's quite common in the choice literature actually to argue, such people have written on voice, is that voice gets its power from choice. That if people know, or the people, the recalcitrant bureaucrat or the recalcitrant hospital administrator or school teacher knows that ultimately the person who is complaining in front of them, exercising their voice very loudly, actually at the end of the day can go, if necessary, can go elsewhere, they're more likely to listen than otherwise. So you could, I think I would argue that yes, people often do, and in fact the origins of the terms, at least voice, was Albert Hirschman, who wrote a book, Exit, Voice and Loyalty, which some of you may well have come across. Exit was the choice option, and voice, he would argue that the voice that needs the power of choice or the power of exit to give it its bite.
Now, Julian's voice is getting a little bit weak. We're going to go with quick. Can we just make quick questions, and we'll just go through another four or five. And I know people have been waiting, but then we'll just try and fit those in. So, if you just be quite quick, please.
Linda Corsha at LSE, and I don't want to comment on the substance of your talk because I actually don't think it had any substance. And but I would like to ask you what naively behaviour you think that primary school teachers and nurses are up to, particularly compared, say, with big business fraud and tax evasion, including of those being invited into the health services providers. And if you can't justify that slur, I actually suggest that you stop making it.
There's actually quite a lot of evidence that's been looked at the motivations of people who work in the public sector and in the private sector. What it tends to suggest is that there is more altruism in the public sector, that there is the balance of knightly and knavish motivations is slightly tends to favour people who work in the public sector. However, it does not mean that that people who work in the public sector are pure altruists, and in fact there are substantial degrees of knavish motivations. Now, those motivations may not necessarily be financial ones, and that tends to be, in the discussion we've had, it's tended to assume that. It can also be a desire for autonomy, a desire for professional status, the whole variety of motivations. And one of the interesting things in this whole area is actually to unpack people's motivations. But if you do live in a world where you believe that everybody who works in the public sector is a pure knight, I'm afraid you're living in a different planet from me.
Can I follow on from that? You mentioned targets, and you were rather sniffy about it. Just following on from this, yes, very quick one. You were rather sniffy about targets, but you can't act without having a purpose, and if you try to, you're going to lose your mind.
It's externally imposed targets I was sniffy about.
I beg your pardon?
Externally imposed targets.
Well, external, internal. The point is, in the health service, for example, people want to live longer, and if you're not regulating that properly, the question is, how do you deal justly, equitably, with your knaves? And that's what's missing in general, as I see it as a management cybernetician in public service management. How do you deal equitably with your knaves is your problem in the public service.
How do I deal equitably with your knaves? Well, maybe we can ponder that.
Okay. There's a lady there that was waiting.
Hi, Carol Proper from Bristol. I was quite intrigued by the fact that you said that you didn't think competition in healthcare would be associated with cream skimming. And I think I'd suggest it's because the nature of choice in healthcare in the UK has been so limited that you don't see any cream skimming, that you've essentially had these patient care advisors who've helped people out and therefore overcome cream skimming. But there are quite big incentives in a system of choice to have cream skimming. And in fact, the evidence from the US is that when you have price shopping, you tend to drop the amount of uncompensated care you have. In other words, doctors and hospitals move away from treating certain patients. And I think that's linked, so that I don't think, I'd kind of question your inference on that one. And I'd also say that I think that's linked to the fact that when you have choice, you've got to have information. And if that information is going to be about quality, it's also going to need to be risk adjusted. If it's not properly risk adjusted, then there's a double motivation for providers to switch away from risky and high-cost patients.
Yes, I think the US evidence on cream skimming tends to concentrate on the cream skimming behaviour of insurers, and it's quite called the risk selection behaviour of insurers, and they clearly do that. So far as hospitals are concerned, well, you mentioned that they tend to switch away from uncompensated care. Well, that's true, but they're not getting any money at all for that. In the British system, we're going to be operating a system by which they will get the same amount of money for each patient with a given diagnosis. So what one's got to posit for serious cream skimming to occur is that they've got to look at the name, the consultant's got to look at the name of that patient, look maybe at the doctor's letters, the letters they've got surrounding it, and then make a decision on the basis that this patient's going to be a difficult and expensive patient, so I'm going to avert my eyes from this patient and go for the other. And that seems to me to be somewhat less plausible than the cream skimming in other situations. But we soon will be able to test it, in a sense, about whether we really are going to get cream skimming, because the system is coming in place. And I do think it's an area we'll have to watch.
OK, I'm not going to be able to get to the rest of you. So the lady there, one or two others, have been waiting a while. So,
Wendy Savage, retired obstetrician. I enjoyed your lecture, Julian, but I did find it very theoretical and so far removed from the reality of those of us who work in the NHS, these terrible consultants who cause us to spend money and are more often knaves than not. But I wasn't clear what is the difference between cherry picking, which is what these diagnostic treatment centres are doing, versus cream skimming. I was unclear about that. And then secondly,
it's the same term, and we don't have any evidence that the independent sectors are cherry picking. There's anecdote, but no evidence.
Right. Secondly, I don't know if you've been reading the series in The Guardian this week about the treatment of the mentally ill in prison. But one of the things that came over again and again was the lack of beds to put these patients in. So I think that the rather rosy research findings that there were spare beds within so much difference, distance of where people lived may well be concealing absolute dearth of beds in particular specialties. And one of the other problems, I think, is that if you rely on the statistics that come out of the NHS, anyone who's ever done any work in the NHS knows that most of them are not worth the paper on which they're written.
Okay. Let me just make a point on the statistics. The interesting thing about the numbers, of course, if you're looking at absolute levels, there are obviously enormous problems in collecting data. The trends, though, tend to be fairly consistent. And unless you are arguing that in some way that the problems of collecting data are getting worse or getting better, the trend data showing directions, for example, the comparison that Gwyn made between England, Scotland, and Northern Ireland, Wales, I have quite a lot of confidence in that because the same problems with data apply to all of those, and yet they show a fairly consistent picture.
Thanks. Richard Cookson, University of York. I'm a little bit sceptical that you really will get any competition from all this choice that's going on because of the well-known political constraints on the market that came out in the internal market. But if you did get some competition going, I wonder if the urban versus rural hospital argument really is a red herring, because the evidence we had from the States, from the airline industry, where you had non-price competition, and from the Medicare prospective payment system, suggests that you do get differences in quality between the monopoly areas and the more competitive areas. And that, you know, may run against the sort of social solidarity inequity.
Sorry, could you just repeat that? You get what, sorry?
So in a more competitive area, if you've got non-price competition, quality will go up in the competitive areas, but it won't go up in the monopoly areas because you don't have competition there, right? So that's an inequity.
Right. I must emphasise, I don't think a choice, not to give the impression that choice is the answer to everything. I also don't wish to imply that rural schools are a trivial problem. I mean, 10% is still a significant problem, but we've got to think of other mechanisms of doing so, of levering up quality in those contexts.
Okay, I'm going to take three. The lady in pink, then the gentleman there, and then three. Sorry, we'll have to... We'll finish the fourth one in, but very quick.
Thank you. Luciana Berger, Birkbeck College. In your analyses, you focused on the disadvantage related to socioeconomic background of citizens. I'm interested in the disadvantage of the black and minority ethnic community highlighted this year in various reports pertaining to both education and the medical field, and how you believe that the notion of choice relates to that community.
Well, just some quick stuff on that. One of the interesting things about choice in the United States on education and education vouchers, the biggest supporters of the education voucher scheme are the black and ethnic minority groups, because they are arguing frequently things like, at last we've actually got a vehicle, at last we've got a way of breaking out of the kind of the bureaucracies and white-dominated bureaucratic systems. Interestingly, in New Zealand, when they specialised in choice for schools, it did lead to a lot of selection problems. But one of the interesting developments was the rise of by Maori for Maori providers. It's really going back to Nick's point about the diversity of supply. One of the things that choice does lead to this. Now, of course, from a wider community point of view, you might say, well, obviously there are tensions here about do you actually wish people to voluntarily take up different types of provision in that way. But I think choice has a lot of implications for ethnic minority groups and often rather favourable ones.
Okay. My name is Sujit, a student here. You said that we need to have choice because sometimes voice and performance management doesn't work. So in that case, would choice be a short-term strategy or do you actually think that it can be sustained?
Well, I think it's a long-term strategy, and that's why I think performance management is a short-term strategy. As I said, it's one that I'm slightly more impressed by than I used to be as a strategy. But I think choice has long-term... I think that choice is a better bet for encouraging people, encouraging motivation, encouraging innovation and empowerment than the alternatives in the longer term.
Okay, Gwyn? We're getting close to the end, but if you can be quick questions, we can finish a couple more in. I'm sorry, people that won't get to answer questions.
Thank you very much. I'll be very quick. In about 10 years ago...
Gwyn Bevan, London School of Economics.
Yeah, Gwyn Bevan, London School of Economics. About 10 years ago, when you organised the quasi-market seminars, if you remember back then, the thing that came through quasi-markets worked is where the providers could exit. And the NHS is classically a case where hospitals don't exit the market. An observation made by John Van Rien and a colleague of ours is that looking at the private sector, markets lead to efficiency is by the poor firms exiting the market and the larger firms expanding. I wonder how you see this playing out in the NHS as to will we see ministers setting close because they're losing money in through payment by results?
It's obviously a real issue, and one of our major planks of the reform we're doing at the moment is trying to develop what we call a failure strategy. And it's the title of the paper at the moment is called Failure is Desirable. Of course, in one respect, choice makes failure a little easier. I mean, all systems of public services have problems dealing with failure. Voice systems, performance managers, they all find it very difficult to deal with failure. One of the advantages of choice systems is that by the time the failure becomes apparent, not many people are using the facility concerned. I mean, it's one of the reasons why the choice works. Then people go to the alternative hospital. So when the hospital actually does get into serious financial difficulty, there aren't many people using it, so actually closing it down becomes rather easier than if there were a lot of people still there. Schools are trickier because obviously you still have children in school. People stay longer at school, and so there clearly are problems about that. Although, interesting enough, I mean, there are cases of successful closure of schools. There are cases of successful closure of hospitals. But it is a real question about whether political systems and the people who work within them, including myself at the moment, will hold their nerve when the phone call comes through from the agonised MP.
Okay, I think we are going to... I'm sorry for those who've been trying to get questions in. It's a chair's nightmare not to have enough questions, but it's an equivalent nightmare to have too many, and I apologise, particularly if I nodded in acknowledgement of your hand and then didn't get to ask you, so apologies for that. I just want to thank Julian very quickly for a most stimulating lecture. I think the range of questions, the nature of the questions, give great evidence of that. So, Julian, thank you very much indeed. Please do come and join us for wine, main building, fifth floor, senior dining room.